From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Catalonia's ousted leader, Carles Puigdemont, and four former ministers have turned themselves in Sunday in Brussels following Spain's issuance of a warrant for their arrest. Puigdemont had said Saturday he intended to cooperate with officials in Brussels, where he fled last week, tweeting that we are prepared to fully cooperate with Belgian justice following the European arrest warrant issued by Spain. A Spanish judge issued the warrant for Puigdemont a day after she jailed nine members of the region's separatist government, pending possible charges over last week's declaration of independence. One person was later granted bail. The national court judge filed the request with the Belgian prosecutor to detain Puigdemont and his four aides and issued separate European search and arrest warrants to alert Interpol in case they fled Belgium. Belgian federal prosecutors said that they had received the arrest warrant and could question Puigdemont in coming days. Puigdemont and the four others were being sought on charges that included rebellion, sedition, and embezzlement as a result of a Spanish investigation into their roles in pushing for secession for Catalonia. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Sunday that the resignation of Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad El-Hiri was a wake-up call to Iran's ultimate plan, saying that Iran is ultimately trying to take over the Middle East. Netanyahu was speaking on BBC's Andrew Marr show. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society says that it has discovered several cases of fraud committed during the height of the Ebola outbreak. This is VOA News. Saudi Arabia's Gulf Affairs Minister said Saturday that he had confirmed information about a plot to kill the Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri from the leader's personal security detail. Hariri announced his resignation Saturday after delivering a blistering attack on Iran and its proxy militia Hezbollah, both in Lebanon and across the region. A car bomb exploded in the Syrian city of Deir ez-Zor, according to the Syrian state agency. Saturday's explosion killed dozens of people, according to both the news agency Sana and the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. The exact death toll is not yet clear. Deir ez-Zor is a center of Syria's oil production and a regional hub for commerce. The city is one of two in which Syrian troops declared victory over IS Friday. The victory along the Iraqi-Syrian border following raids by forces on either side of the border near the Euphrates Valley. The jihadist group's self-proclaimed caliphate was in tatters after it lost its urban strongholds in Syria and Iraq, with the simultaneous assaults on Deir ez-Zor in Syria and Al-Qaim in Iraq, leaving IS in control of little more than small plots of territory scattered along the border. Saudi Arabia state media says it has intercepted a ballistic missile fired from Yemen and aimed at the King Khalid International Airport northeast of Riyadh. Iran-backed Houthi fighters in Yemen have claimed responsibility for the missile, which was intercepted by Saudi forces. Saudi authorities said that it caused no casualties or major damage. The Houthis said that they were targeting the airport. Saudi Arabia is leading a mission in Yemen to eliminate the Houthi forces, but the violence has begun to spill over the border. In July, the Saudis shot down a ballistic missile from Yemen to Mecca, or near Mecca, a month before Muslims begin their annual pilgrimage to the city. U.S. President Donald Trump told servicemen Sunday at Yokota Air Base in Japan that no one, no dictator, no regime should underestimate American resolve.
History has proven over and over that the road of the tyrant is a steady march toward poverty, suffering, and servitude. But the path of strong nations and free people, certain of their values and confident in their futures, is a proven path toward prosperity and peace.
Some of the president's comments, while directed at the American troops, could also be seen as a veiled warning to the isolated nation of North Korea. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News, and Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. Our moderator is contributing editor to the National Journal, Tom DeFrank.
Good day. Here are today's issues in the news from Washington. A terrorist attack in New York killed 8 people. The suspect is an Uzbek national who's been in the United States for 7 years. A special prosecutor investigating Russia's attempts to influence the 2016 election charged 3 members of President Trump's campaign, including his former campaign manager. And President Trump has begun a trip to Asia that will focus on North Korea's nuclear weapons threat and trade issues. Well, we have seen car bombings for a long time by terrorists. We've also seen where terrorists rent a truck and then drive over people. The worst of these in recent years was in Nice, France, which killed several dozen people. Now this new technique, new sick technique, I should say, has come to the United States. Saipulo Saipov, a 29-year-old Uzbek, was the alleged perpetrator. He has been charged. President Trump has called him an animal and said he should be executed. Oren, what else do we know about him?
Well, he came here on what's called the diversity lottery, which is basically a lottery that allows some 50,000 people to come into the United States from almost anywhere around the world. They're not allowed to come if they're convicted criminals or members of terrorist organizations, but otherwise it's basically a lottery. The president has said that he wants to end this program, and it's causing a little bit of a political hay, I guess, very close to the time of this terrorist attack.
It's once again become a case where President Trump wants to take action, and that's how he wants to be seen. There was an attack in his hometown, New York City. 8 people killed. 6 of them were foreigners, by the way, visitors from other countries. That's the way things are in New York. And ironically, and probably intentionally by the terrorist, it was right next to the site of the World Trade Center, the major attack of 9/11. 16 years ago. So Trump declared that he wants to end this lottery program that the White House claims hardly checks who these people are. Just the most minimal of checking, that they don't have a criminal record in their home country and that they have a high school education. No interrogation by security authorities, no questioning by the U.S. Embassy to find out, what do you want to do in the United States? Will you actually contribute to America? It's really resonating here in this country with people who pay attention that it's okay to bring in immigrants. And that is what the White House is saying, though we generally have a tone that they don't want so many immigrants as in the past. But the White House is saying everyone should be checked. Will they contribute to U.S. society? And this terrorist Saipov was allowed in at age 22 from Uzbekistan, and Trump says that was clearly a mistake.
The Diversity Visa Lottery, which is its official name, has been around since 1995. And it was authorized on a bipartisan basis. Now, the president is saying this was the brainchild of Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. It should also be noted that members of Congress have felt like that this was a problem. This was a flawed program, as Dan has suggested. There was less vetting. The other thing is, if you win the lottery, so to speak, you don't have to show that you have a job. You don't have to show you have a sponsor in the United States.
So you're in. You have the right to live and work in this country. So it's amazing. It's considered a golden ticket. But that word diversity, it's because Congress determined, and it really was bipartisan, that America should have people from all around the world of every color and ethnicity. So the question is, and I'm sure our listeners around the world will wonder, does America still want that?
So what's interesting about this program is that it was initially created to give more of a chance to Irish and Italian immigrants. And because the economics, by the time the law actually passed, the economics in Ireland changed, it ended up benefiting more Africans and Central Asians and Turks and Bulgarians, people from Eastern Europe. But yeah, the advocates say that that many of these immigrants have driven U.S. economic growth, that they've been entrepreneurs, that they come here and get an education, and that the United States doesn't have the same demographic-based economic problems that Europe and Japan do, for instance, because we have this type of immigration from other countries. But the critics are saying that if we allow people from other countries, we should bring them in on a merit-based system, screening them in advance for what they would add to the American economy.
Right, but I think it's very likely that this program is going to be scaled back. I mean, in 2013, when there was a real attempt in Congress to have a comprehensive immigration reform enacted, the legislation which passed the Senate would have done away with this program. But for a variety of reasons, it died in the Republican-led House of Representatives, who they didn't like this program, but they didn't like some other provisions of the bill that would have allegedly made it easier for undocumented immigrants to stay in the country.
I think it's fair to note that Senator Schumer, who was one of the sponsors of the 1995 law, was also one of the sponsors of the 2013 bill that would have done away with this program.
That's right. So what do you think happens, Dan? I mean, the president is very vehement about this. He says no more of this diversity stuff. We need to have a merit-based. And it's probably, I'm just guessing, that the polls will show that that's a fairly popular sentiment right now.
I would think, too, but it doesn't necessarily lead to comprehensive immigration reform that includes what to do about immigrants who are already in the United States, often undocumented without papers. That's, of course, a big focus for President Trump. He wants to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. He says that those people are troublemakers, and that's the general image he wants to give. And that's why, again, the image of America is what's under a cloud or a question right now as to whether we are so open and welcoming. In the age of Trump, and it's only been 1 year since his election, I think the tone has changed.
Right, absolutely.
So there's another element that he wants to do away with, which is what he calls chain immigration, and other people call the family reunification program of the U.S. visa program, immigration system. And this allows immigrants who do have green cards or do have citizenship to also sponsor their children, their adult children's spouses, their parents, their siblings.
And Saipov, the alleged terrorist in New York, right? President Trump said that Saipov was able to bring in 23 relatives that way.
Right. So again, the critics and the president say that this has caused, you know, uncontrolled mushrooming immigration. Supporters say that family unification is one of the things that shows that America is open to the world. But the president wants to trade with part of what you were describing about the people who are already here. There's the deferred action DACA,
which is for children who were brought in by their parents.
Children who were brought in by their parents. He wants to allow that to remain and turn into law.
So-called dreamers.
The dreamers.
Dreamers.
And but in return, he wants the Democrats to support an end to what he calls chain immigration or family reunification.
And building that wall.
And building the wall.
Yeah, so there's going to be lots of negotiations to see how this sorts out, but I think it's fair to say it's probably likely that this particular program, the lottery system, which President Trump called a Democrat lottery system, it's probably, fair or not, I think it's probably going to be scaled back some, for sure. I mean, before we go to another subject, I want to just mention the irony of this attack in New York. I mean, it's ironic because there's no question that ISIS is on the run in the Middle East, in Afghanistan and Iraq. Iraqi forces aided and abetted by American troops, a lot of special forces, have made dramatic gains in the last 2 years in pushing ISIS out of a lot of its territory. But experts have said that's the good news. The bad news is ISIS and other terrorists are going to go to smaller scale attacks because they're easier to pull off and harder to detect. And that's what has happened here. And you get this awful feeling, Dan, that Mr. Saipov, who has now been charged in these murders, it was easy for him and anybody else to just rent a truck.
It may be part of life in this modern age. And it's right. As the Islamic State, ISIS, is being defeated in Iraq and Syria, that organization will keep inspiring some extremists in Western countries, including the U.S.
Right. Let us turn now to the probe by Robert Mueller, a special prosecutor who has been looking into Russian attempts to influence the 2016 presidential election. A Washington grand jury has indicted two lobbyists, including former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort, on multiple counts of money laundering, conspiracy, and other alleged crimes. A third individual, who was an unpaid low-level campaign volunteer, pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI and has been cooperating with Mr. Mueller's probe. Now, we should be clear that the indictments did not mention the Trump campaign, and President Trump and his advisors have once again vigorously insisted there was no collusion on the part of his campaign. But all three of these individuals were affiliated with the campaign. Orrin, how big of a problem potentially is this for President Trump in this ongoing investigation?
Well, it's hard to say for sure, but this stage of the investigation, indictments and arrests and guilty pleas, is just getting started. So this is basically the FBI is following the pattern of a RICO investigation, where they go after
racketeering,
where they go after low-level officials, low-level associates, and get them to turn against higher-level associates and to provide testimony and information about people near the top. In this case, I think the most interesting, a lot of the stuff about Manafort and Gates was already part of the public record. People knew about their work in Ukraine and in Russia, and working with high-level Ukrainian and Russian officials who are close to the Russian government. But we didn't know a whole lot about George Papadopoulos, and I find his guilty plea and the information that was presented with that the most interesting, because he had multiple attempts of trying to connect the Trump campaign with Russian officials, and he sent a lot of emails. There's a big long email record of him communicating with top level Trump campaign officials and telling them about his efforts to talk to people about who claim to have dirt on, in quotes, dirt on Hillary Clinton, and to also set up a meeting between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Of course, that's important, whether candidate Trump knew that someone in his campaign, albeit an unpaid volunteer, Papadopoulos, had contacts with people in London who spoke about giving negative information, including hacked emails, to the Trump campaign, and maybe even Trump should get together with Vladimir Putin. Did Trump hear about it? In interviews, he has said, no one in my campaign, as far as I know, had any contacts with Russians. And the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, he was a senator last year who was very active in the Trump campaign. Well, there's a photo of Trump and Sessions and Papadopoulos and others at a planning meeting. And the question arises whether everyone's telling the truth or not. Papadopoulos, of course, admitted lying to FBI agents, and we wonder if now his account is truthful.
Well, the White House quickly moved to label him a liar. We're going to talk a lot more about this topic and Mr. Papadopoulos in just a moment, but we're going to take a short break here.
More of Issues in the News in just a moment. This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. This is a reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Orrin Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and moderator Tom DeFrank, contributing editor of the National Journal.
Now, let's go back to George Papadopoulos and this investigation. I mean, I think Dan and Orrin, you both hit the nail on the head here. Papadopoulos has pleaded guilty to lying to the government. So that makes him an easy target for the White House and the president's defenders, who say, well, he's a liar, so he's probably lied about everything. But we will see about this. The only other thing I would say is that I know that the White House was caught by surprise about the Papadopoulos indictment or a guilty plea. The president and his press secretary have continued to say, we think this investigation will end very soon.
It's got to be wishful thinking, Tom.
I think so, Dan. I've covered a lot of these, as all three of us have, and usually the first indictments are not the the beginning of the end. It's usually the end of the beginning. And for instance, there is nothing in this first wave of indictments or guilty pleas that have anything to do with retired Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who is widely believed to be a key target of investigators.
Mm-hmm. And for a while, he was National Security Advisor in the White House until fired. You know, mostly what for? For supposedly lying to Vice President Pence about Flynn's foreign contacts.
Right. Exactly right. And he was forced out after 24 days as the president's National Security Advisor. And just as there was widespread expectation that Mr. Manafort and his business partner were going to be indicted, there is a widespread sense that General Flynn, when all is said and done, is going to be indicted as well. We will just have to see. Now, Oren, there is a ancillary piece of fascinating piece of information here about the Russians' attempt to influence the election in November a year ago this month. And that is the whole role of the Russians in social media. Now, social media mandarins told Congress a few days ago that Russia's interference or attempts to interfere in the election may be more extensive than originally thought. The Russians operatives purchased hundreds of ads, maybe 3,000 ads on social media, and all of which were attempts to influence public opinion in that election. What can you say about this and where it goes from here, Oren?
Well, so I'm laughing because we've been writing about this sort of thing for months. So it's interesting to see Google and Twitter and Facebook come forward and actually talk about what their records contain. But what they described basically was a pattern of Russians basically not only buying ads, but also organizing events and recruiting people in the United States to organize events, and sometimes pushing them or encouraging them to engage in violence for both sides, opposing sides, to engage in violence at these events. There was one in Texas. So they were basically trying to gin up the violence and the fighting between the left and the right in this country, and without anyone realizing who was behind it and that they were behind it.
Oren, did you get the impression in that congressional testimony, mainly by Twitter and Facebook, it's really the ones that we noticed, that they agreed with the notion that the Russian meddling seemed to be on behalf of Donald Trump, or more specifically, against Hillary Clinton? That still was the general tone, I thought, as well as just trying to cause unrest in the U.S.
Right. But I mean, there's a lot of evidence, I would say, that the Russian social media still is very hard on Hillary Clinton and is still rather soft on Donald Trump. And I thought that I saw a message from Maria Zakharova, who's the Russian foreign ministry spokesman or Russian government spokeswoman, saying that so apparently now Twitter is not taking these ads anymore from the Russians, and she said that that's an example or evidence of Twitter's subjugation to the U.S. government.
What the Russians did in 2016, it's fair to say they will do again in 2020, because in addition to the were they for Trump or against Hillary or whatever, part of the Russian game here, it's a serious game, is to destabilize Western democracies. And so you can be sure, however the 2016 calculation sorts out, the Russians will be back at this in 2016. Now, in the few minutes we have left, let's go to President Trump's foreign trip. He has begun the longest trip of his presidency, a 12-day, five-nation visit to Japan, China, South Korea, Vietnam, and the Philippines. It's the longest trip to Asia by a president of the United States in about a quarter of a century. Quite elaborate, quite intensive 12 days of diplomacy. Dan, what do you think the president really hopes to accomplish? I assume everybody's saying the two main things he's trying to do is deal with North Korea and deal with trade. So what's your take on
that? Those are definitely the main points, but North Korea comes first because the Trump White House puts security first. And his national security advisor, General H.R. McMaster, told reporters just before the trip that the focus is on North Korea and getting a regional coalition, including China, which is certainly something that's been said by the Trump White House all year, but they mean now face-to-face, President Trump meeting with President Xi of China. That's the important set of meetings, I would say, above all.
Orrin, as we all know, President Trump has met with President Xi before. He had an elaborate bilateral meeting with him at Mar-a-Lago, President Trump's Florida resort and club. So this is not the first time they've done this, but as Dan says, this is really going to be the most intensive one-on-one between the two. The White House has said, General McMaster and others have said, that China is becoming more receptive to really, truly cracking down on North Korea. Do you see evidence of that?
Yes and no. I would say that the Chinese are saying that that the North Korean nuclear program, they actually say that it's a threat to themselves, which is, I think you have to take it. I'm not sure you can take that at complete face value, but because a lot of the equipment and funding that goes into the North Korean nuclear program comes from China, but that's what they say, and they are proposing that the United States and North Korea, deal with this basically between themselves, that they talk to each other. Which is something that the Trump administration has begun to try to do a little bit, but I think that this meeting between Xi and Trump is likely to be. I'd love to be a fly on that wall in that room.
Yeah. Well, very briefly, I just want to mention trade because one of the first things President Trump did was decide not to proceed with TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was an idea of the Obama administration to box China out and have a trade deal with more than a dozen countries around the Pacific. So that's gone. So now the Trump administration is committed to having one-on-one deals with all those countries he's visiting and more.
The question is whether that helps China, which many people think it does, or whether it provides additional leverage maybe for the Trump administration to try to refloat something like TPP or something different that would be similar to TPP. But the issue here is that the Chinese have a lot of leverage in East Asia. I think that the fact that the way this trip is being described as an effort to strengthen engagement in the Indo-Pacific countries. It kind of leaves out the whole idea of Asia and China out of the title. But China is really the big question mark in this entire effort to change the North Korean behavior because they control so much of the trade that North Korea does with the rest of the world.
Well, a week from today when we are back at these microphones, President Trump will still be abroad. And I suspect we will know a lot more about these issues and we'll have a much better feel, I believe, about where the Chinese really are and where we as a nation and we as a global entity are heading towards what happens with North Korea. But that's all the time we have today. Thanks to Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News, and Orrin Darel of USA Today, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and I'm Tom DeFrank, contributing editor for National Journal. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim Malone. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Jeffrey Rosen, President and Chief Executive Officer of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It's an agency created by Congress to publish nonpartisan information about the Constitution. Jeffrey Rosen is also a law professor at George Washington University and a contributing editor of The Atlantic magazine. His most recent book is Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet, about which we had the pleasure of interviewing Jeffrey on this show last year. Our topic on this edition of the program, the First Amendment in the Age of Trump. The First Amendment to the Constitution reads, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. It is a quintessential American civil right, viewed worldwide with hope by dissidents living under censorship and with dread by powerful interests seeking to curb speech that leads to political liberty and change." However, analysts and civil society groups in the United States are wondering if the cherished First Amendment is under assault or is being manipulated by some groups to allow for what could be described as hate speech, which leads to intimidation or even violence against certain minority groups. In the wake of the so-called Unite the Right march in Charlottesville, Virginia last August, when deadly clashes erupted between torch-bearing white supremacists, Ku Klux Klan members and anti-Semites who chanted, "Jews will not replace us," and counter-protesters, is it time for Americans to re-examine the parameters of this cherished right? Where does free speech leave off and incitement to violence begin? Where does free speech end and domestic terrorism begin? In addition, in both his campaign for president and now in the White House, U.S. President Donald Trump has waged a battle not just against specific news stories or organizations, but also with the notion of what is true or fake. All presidents have viewed the media as adversarial at various points of their administrations, yet none have gone quite so far as to claim that information that flatters is the only information that matters. The notion of the press as the so-called enemy is seen as disturbing by constitutional scholars and many in the news media. We'll talk with Jeffrey Rosen about these controversial issues and much more. And Jeffrey Rosen joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Jeffrey, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
And I'm always delighted to welcome my colleague, Jim Malone.
Great to be here.
Well, Jeffrey, that was a long introduction. Nonetheless, just to set up the context, do you think it is time for Americans to re-examine this broad definition of free speech in light of this uptick in hate crimes we're seeing in the United States, the rise of white supremacist and anti-Semitic groups, and the subsequent intimidation and acts of violence we're witnessing?
No, I do not think it is time for Americans to re-examine our First Amendment tradition. I think it is the crown jewel of the American constitutional tradition, embraced by liberal and conservative justices and by framers of the Constitution ranging from Jefferson and Madison to great exponents like Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court justice who we had the pleasure of talking about recently. The American free speech tradition holds unequivocally that hate speech is protected unless it is intended to and likely to incite imminent violence. That is the most speech-protective standard in the world. Most of your listeners do not live in countries that protect hate speech as vigorously and constrain the government from restricting speech as unequivocally as the U.S. I would love to talk about why I believe it is a wonderful thing for American democracy that we allow for protection of what Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes called the thought we hate, and why we insist that speech can only be banned when intended to and likely to cause imminent violence.
Okay, so what about the context we're talking about? We're seeing people marching, white supremacists, Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, using free speech to defend their right to march. And of course, that is permitted, but do you not think it is veering these types of groups and their actions into incitement
to violence and, in fact, violence. We saw a death in Charlottesville, Virginia in August.
I think it is extraordinarily important for your listeners to be as precise as possible in distinguishing between the kind of speech that is protected and the kind that is not. Peaceful protests, even by neo-Nazis, are unequivocally protected by the Supreme Court. In an important case called the Brandenburg case in 1967, the court held that someone at a Ku Klux Klan rally was permitted to stand up and say, unless the racial situation changes in the U.S., some revengeance might have to be taken by white people. That was protected because it was neither intended to nor likely to cause imminent violence, even though it was hateful. Similarly, the Supreme Court held that neo-Nazis were permitted to march in Skokie, Illinois, as long as their protests were neither intended to nor likely to incite imminent violence. Now, the question of what happened in Charlottesville was a great tragedy, of course, and of obviously a terrorist who takes a car into a crowd and kills people is a criminal activity that should be and has been seriously prosecuted. The question of what the parameter should be when protesters on both sides are armed and carrying weapons, and whether that is more likely to incite imminent violence, and whether it's even intended to create violence, is a hard question. And the American Civil Liberties Union, which vigorously defended the rights of the alt-right Charlottesville protesters to protest in front of the Robert E. Lee statue after the tragedy, decided they would no longer defend protesters who were carrying weapons because they believed that there was such a high chance that those weapons would lead to violence, and in fact they were almost intended to incite violence, that it fit within that incitement test. So post-Charlottesville raised all sorts of hard questions. There were also hard legal questions about whether people who wore military fatigues and carried guns were impersonating the militia in contravention of state laws prohibiting that, dating back to the Civil War era. But the broad question of whether hateful neo-Nazis and also people on the left who take similarly extreme positions are permitted to march and express their hateful views is protected by the First Amendment, the answer is unequivocally yes, they are permitted to do that.
You made a very important distinction just now between those who are armed and are terrorizing people and those who are not. And I think that's what we did see in Charlottesville, the arming of these marchers, and that made all the difference. Now I'd like to turn to my colleague Jim Malone for a question.
I wanted to ask about your work at the Constitution Center, and in particular, many Americans have this idea of the Constitution as this archaic document drawn up through the then founding fathers. How much of an understanding do Americans have today about the importance of the Constitution, how it in fact is a living document, and what are your goals in terms of, say, educationally, just enlightening people about the wisdom contained in the Constitution and how it really does set the blueprint for our democracy?
Thank you so much for asking about the Constitution Center, and I'm so excited to share our educational mission with your listeners around the world. The Constitution Center is a very unique institution. It's the only institution created by the U.S. Congress, even though it's a private nonprofit, to enlighten people about the Constitution in a nonpartisan way. So I want your listeners to go online at constitutioncenter.org or to the App Store, where you can find our app called the Interactive Constitution. And we've assembled the top liberal and conservative scholars in America to write about every clause of the Constitution, describing what they agree about and what they disagree about. So you can go to the First Amendment Free Speech Clause and see top scholars talking about the issues we're talking about. And it's exciting to see that both the liberals and conservatives embrace that free speech tradition I just defended, that speech can only be banned when it's intended to and likely to cause imminent violence, although they disagree about applications in particular situations. And multiply that by all 80 clauses of the Constitution. And Voice of America listeners, this is a tremendous opportunity to educate yourself about one of the shining documents of human freedom and to see areas of agreement and disagreement. It's very exciting. In addition, on the Interactive Constitution website and at constitutioncenter.org, you can click on any part of the U.S. Constitution and compare it to rights around the globe. So, to take just one example, if we clicked on the American Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures, and you click on Japan, you see that when General Douglas MacArthur wrote the Japanese Constitution, he cut and pasted the American Fourth Amendment, so the words are almost exactly the same, whereas the French First Amendment, for example, looks little like ours. So, international listeners, it's really exciting to be able to look at your constitutions, compare it to the U.S., see which rights you have and we don't, and vice versa, and we can have this great conversation about constitutionalism at a time when constitutionalism is under siege. We are seeing threats to the rule of law and an independent judiciary coming from populist political movements around the globe, and it's very important to educate yourself about basic human rights, free speech, freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, the right to due process of law, so that you can defend those rights when they're under assault. So that's the Constitution Center's educational mission. It's really exciting. Also on the website, we have a weekly podcast called We the People, where I get to interview the top liberal and conservative scholars in the country on the constitutional issue of the week, which is a great way to educate yourself. And there's just so much to learn. And I want you, Voice of America listeners, to realize the Constitution is not just for U.S. citizens. It's this shining beacon of freedom that embodies Enlightenment ideals that came from the Scottish Enlightenment, from Britain, dating back to Greece and Rome. And it really is a universal heritage that I want all of you to educate yourself about.
Well, Jeffrey Rosen, thank you so much for that explanation. And I'm sure all of our listeners, as I will go to the website and educate ourselves. I'd like to turn back to what happened in Charlottesville specifically, because I would like you, in a comparative light, to look at that. For example, in Germany, which confronted the Holocaust, in that regard, made laws against those who would deny the Holocaust. I mean, that was a terrible tragedy. 6 million Jews and so many other people perished. The question is why is it that the United States perhaps cannot do something similar? For example, in light of our legacy of slavery and the Civil War, and we saw, you know, that some of these white supremacist groups want to defend Confederate symbols, which are very hateful, which symbolize a terror for many groups, particularly African Americans. Why is it that in this country, we can't perhaps make similar laws as we see in Germany against denying the Holocaust, laws against groups who are goading those who are victims of, for example, the legacy of slavery?
Yes, Germany and Europe have a very different free speech tradition than we do. In Germany, as you say, it is permissible to ban speech that is hateful because Europeans have a tradition of protecting dignity. The German Constitution recognizes dignity as a constitutional right, and because of the unique legacy of the Holocaust, both Germany and France and other European countries allow the banning of hate speech that offends the dignity of groups. The U.S. has a very different tradition because our tradition comes from the notion of liberty, and it comes from Jefferson and Madison, who believed that complete freedom of conscience and opinion were natural rights that came from God or nature rather than from government and could not be alienated to government when we create civil societies, because our opinions are the product of our reason. And as people of the Enlightenment, our founders believe that we cannot alienate our reason to government because it defines who we are as human beings. It is the case that the First Amendment free speech protections, of course, have protected abolitionists who oppose slavery in the same way that they protected Confederates who defended it. And many of the most egregious offenses against free speech came in the antebellum era when the abolitionist pamphlets were forbidden from being mailed in the South, and the abolitionists invoking Jefferson and Madison insisted that their natural rights were being defended. So for all these reasons, I think the American tradition has proved to be persuasive. And although hate exists in every country in the world, and of course online it's even more easy to express and is rampant, there's no evidence that there is less hate. There are fewer hate crimes in countries that ban hate speech than in the U.S. By contrast, there appears to be more hateful activity in Europe at the moment than there is even in the U.S. So both empirically and philosophically, the U.S. has made the judgment that the best response to evil speech is counter speech, that because people have the power to use their powers of deliberation, they should be free to reject bad counsels rather than have them banned. And that's why we're different. Might I say one more thing about a crucial new right to be forgotten on the internet that Europe has embraced and which shows more dramatically than anything else the difference between the U.S. and the European free speech tradition? The European Court of Justice recently held that anyone in Europe who objects to speech that offends their dignity or they consider irrelevant or outdated can demand that Google and Yahoo and other search engines remove it. And if Google guesses wrong and a privacy commissioner decides that it's not relevant to the public interest or the public concern, then Google can be fined up to 2% of its annual income, which last year was $60 billion. So that concentrates the mind. Google has removed 43% of the requests for takedown it's received, including to take down articles about the right to be forgotten itself. And this just shows how powerfully Europeans believe that truthful but embarrassing speech that offends dignity can be removed, whereas Americans insist that it can't.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Jeffrey Rosen. He's president and CEO of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. He's also professor of law at George Washington University. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Mahmouda Idi Jimeta from Zaria, Kaduna State in Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now a question from Jim Malone.
Yeah, I wanted to take you back just to the point you were making about what they're doing in Europe. Do you see anything like that happening here in the United States? There's so much concern in the aftermath of the presidential campaign with so-called fake news, with what people are allowed to put on the web and so forth, whether the usual First Amendment free speech rights apply and all of that. Where do you see this country headed on that kind of issue?
Yes, it's a great question, and we might be headed in a more European-like direction online because Facebook and Google, unlike the U.S. government, are not bound by the First Amendment. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. It doesn't say Mark Zuckerberg shall make no law. And Facebook just recently adopted new fake news guidelines that will make it harder for the Facebook algorithm to promote sites that have been tagged by users as involving fake news and will make it harder to serve ads against it and so forth. And Facebook and Google, unlike the First Amendment, do prohibit speech that criticizes groups on the basis of race or religion. In the U.S. government can't ban someone from saying, I hate a religious group, but on Facebook you're not allowed to say it because they're free to create whatever boundaries they like. So I do see that in light of concerns about fake news, there'll both be pressure on the platforms to try to flag it more than they're doing now, and continued pressure to restrict the kind of hate speech that the First Amendment protects.
I wanted to ask you too about, I think you mentioned earlier perhaps some underlying tensions. The way our country is set up with the three branches of government, the Congress, the President, the Supreme Court, the judicial branch, we have a populist president now who breaks a lot of political rules, so to speak. And I wonder, do you sense any greater concern, scrutiny about constitutional mores in the age of Donald Trump, with his followers, with some of the things the president is known to say or tweet?
Well, we're having a vigorous constitutional debate about where the boundaries should be in this country, and we see it every day in the news. Obviously, in the courts, there are a series of the president's actions that have been challenged, ranging from the travel ban, which has gone through several rounds before the Supreme Court and other courts, to executive orders which repeal regulations, to even a suit against the president for blocking users on his Twitter account on the grounds that Twitter is a public platform and it's an act of censorship to block someone. So there's a vigorous debate, and it's a healthy debate. It's one of the glories of the American constitutional system that we're sitting here on Voice of America, of all places, and having this debate about the president and the Constitution, and the fact that we're seeing Congress people from the president's own party stand up and saying that he is violating constitutional norms is another reminder of the fact that in the U.S., the president doesn't have all the power. The executive branch has to share power with the legislative branch and ultimately the judicial branch as well as the states. And all of a sudden, constitutional structural checks like separation of powers and checks and balances are looking much more appealing to progressives, for example, who might have celebrated President Obama for his use of executive orders and passing deferred deportation for the so-called Dreamers, but are less enamored of executive orders when they're being used by President Trump. So it's a vigorous, healthy debate, and I think it's really a sign of the American system at its best.
Jeffrey Rosen, back to your statement about free speech, and you said it's banned only when it's intended to lead to violence. So if groups are armed that are under the pretext of marching under the right of free speech, they're actually armed and intimidating others. So to what extent are we there, perhaps, in light of the Charlottesville march? We're seeing the rise of other groups, white supremacist groups, trying to make inroads in universities. Where does free speech then end and a sort of domestic terrorism begin?
So the test is even more demanding. Intended to and likely to cause imminent violence. Those are those three requirements. It has to be intended to lead to violence, it has to be likely to lead to violence, and the violence has to be imminent. That is a beautiful test that comes from Justice Brandeis's concurring opinion in the Whitney in California case from 1927. And the reason that Brandeis was so scrupulous is he thought as long as there's time enough for deliberation, then public discussion is a political duty, and this should be a fundamental principle of the American government, a great faith in reason. Are we there? Yet no, Charlottesville, merely carrying guns, which in America is legal, I think, in Virginia, and marching and saying, I hate Jews, as hateful and intimidating as that is, by itself does not meet the standard of being intended to and likely to cause imminent violence. Now, you can disagree about whether once the counter-protesters started, violence was so likely to result that there should be a time, place, and manner restriction that might have moved the protest or shut it down. But we can't overstate how protective this test is. And stuff that seems really scary and really hateful, and obviously no one would possibly endorse, is protected under the U.S. Constitution because we have so much faith in the power of deliberation rather than suppressing speech.
And of course, President Trump signed a resolution which was passed by Congress condemning white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and other hate groups. To what extent do these types of measures have an impact on the growing influence and prevalence of these groups?
Well, growing influence, of course, is an empirical question, and I would want to see evidence about whether they have growing influence or not. But, of course, the appropriate thing to do when you're faced with hate groups is to denounce them vigorously. And the President and Congress were absolutely right to denounce the appalling, hateful sentiments of these groups, and all of the online denunciations were welcome as well. The best response to evil counsels is good ones. That's Brandeis's point. Now, the hard lines, and there's so many hard ones, or what about the heckler's veto? A recent poll by the Brookings Institution found that 20% of the 1,500 undergraduates polled thought that violence was an appropriate response to hate speech or shouting someone down. And the American First Amendment does not allow shouting someone down. That's called a heckler's veto. The fact that you really disagree with the speech doesn't allow you to prevent the speaker from speaking. You're supposed to express your protest in a way that allows the speech to continue, and then all voices can be heard and the public can make up its own mind. So this is creating really tough practical questions for university presidents, for example, who are complaining, why do we have to spend $1 million to protect a controversial, hateful speaker in order to ensure that everyone can be heard? And there are no easy answers to that question, and the Constitution doesn't tell you what exactly to do there. But we do have this basic idea that the right response to hateful speech is to denounce it, not to try to ban it.
Now, what about this other issue that we're seeing in the United States, allegations of fake news, when in fact the fake news is simply unflattering to the president in many cases? He's been denouncing network news that he doesn't consider flattering or credible as fake. On the other hand, this is the kind of news that, you know, is sourced and has been edited. What do you make of this issue and characterizing the press as the enemy?
The line between fact and opinion is the most difficult to police. And it was for that reason that Jefferson, who believed so keenly in complete freedom of opinion as the quintessential natural right, was not in favor of the government suppressing speech on the grounds of its falsity in general, unless it was a form of libel, for example, was clearly false or published with reckless disregard of its truth or falsity, and also harmful on reputation. So saying that speech you disagree with or that criticizes you or that expresses opinions you repudiate is fake is itself an expression of opinion and is really objecting to the content rather than the truth or falsehood. On the other hand, there is some news that everyone agrees is fake, that is news set up by algorithms or bots that are generated for the specific purpose of spreading disinformation on groups like Facebook with the intent of interfering in elections or creating chaos.
And of course, we saw that in our last election by the Russians.
We did. The CIA and the FBI both concluded that fake news had been disseminated during the election by the Russians. Even acknowledging that there is a category of fake news doesn't mean that it's easy to identify. And Facebook at the moment is asking users to flag news they believe to be fake, but that may ultimately put the responsibility on human reviewers to make judgments about what's fake and what isn't. So identifying and restricting fake news is not an easy problem, and it's not clear that the platforms should be in the business of considering themselves editors or newsstands rather than neutral platforms. But we understand how rattling it is in a democracy when people can no longer agree on facts. The whole Brandeisian faith was that citizens in a democracy could hear all arguments, even hateful ones, so they could converge around a common understanding of facts. And now that we're all living in our own filter bubbles and echo chambers, and one side's fake news is another side's truth, is really alarming for a democracy.
Back to you again, Jeffrey Rosen. Mr. Trump recently advocated revoking licenses of TV networks whose news reports he labels as fake. Now, of course, he can't do that, but he's advocating that. Do you think these types of statements have a troubling impact on civic discourse? Saying this, again, we have to educate ourselves what the president can or cannot do. What impact does this have on our civic discourse?
The National Constitution Center takes our mandate to be nonpartisan very seriously, so I can describe, does the president have the power to revoke the licenses of networks with whose speech he disagrees? Technically, he could instruct the Federal Communications Commission to revoke a license, but the Administrative Procedure Act would restrict his ability to wreak his will, and the First Amendment ultimately would prohibit the revocation of license purely on the basis of the speech with which the government disagreed. So to the degree that the president could be construed as making a threat that might violate the First Amendment, I guess I can say that that wouldn't be a good thing because the president's not allowed to violate the First Amendment. Beyond that, I think I'll leave it to the policy experts to characterize.
One of the things about the Constitution is that Americans can try to change it. They can add whatever. There's a whole process to do with that. It has to go through Congress and the various states. But I think the last amendment, if I'm not mistaken, was it early 90s? Congressional pay, I think, something to do with that. Anything in the pipeline or any prospects, do you think, for any changes to the Constitution that you see in the landscape at this time?
Another great question. Yes, there was that 1992 amendment, the 27th Amendment, amazingly had been proposed with the original Bill of Rights. It was the original Second Amendment. I'm getting wonky here, but we have at the Constitution Center one of the 12 original copies of the Bill of Rights, and there were not 10 amendments, but 12. And the original Second Amendment wasn't the right to bear arms. It was the one about congressional pay, and that was only ratified nearly 200 years later when some grad student noticed, hey, this almost enough states have ratified this. We just need a few more, and then the rest of them got on board. Are there any in the pipeline? Yes. 27 states, if I have it right, have asked Congress to call a convention to pass a balanced budget amendment. So you only need 34 states to require Congress to call the convention of the states, a procedure that's never been triggered before. Most amendments have been proposed by votes of two-thirds of both houses of Congress. So it's not inconceivable, although I wouldn't necessarily bet on it, that you could have a convention of the states to consider a balanced budget amendment. Then the question is, could the convention go rogue? Because although it would be called to pass a balanced budget amendment, once the convention is called, nothing prevents the delegates from passing and proposing whatever amendments they like. And that's why some people say we shouldn't take the risk. Now, even if the convention went rogue and proposed some pretty wacky amendments, to be ratified and to become part of the Constitution, any amendment has to be ratified by three-quarters of the state legislatures or by special conventions called in three-quarters of the states. So the chance of anything that lots and lots of Americans didn't profoundly support actually becoming part of the Constitution is very low because it's so hard to pass a constitutional amendment. But I think a balanced budget amendment is the most likely candidate.
Jeffrey Rosen is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. He's also professor of law at George Washington University. Jeffrey Rosen, thank you so much for your insights on the U.S. Constitution and particularly the First Amendment.
Thank you. A pleasure as always.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rob McLean. And joining me on the program was VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim Malone. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.